Thank you for joining us. I'm Donald Whitehead. I'm the executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. And you'll be joining us on The Voices of Homelessness. And this show is designed to bring you the voices, the faces, the stories of people experiencing homelessness. Many of our stories are about overcoming homelessness and those who've experienced some success, because that is the majority of the people who actually experience this issue. You will hear stories sometimes of the opposite, that most people experiencing homelessness come from kind of a different space. But the truth is, the majority of people who are homeless, it's an episodic issue, and it has many different causes. And we're here to set the story straight, and just very excited. The National Coalition is the oldest advocacy organization. We actually invented or wrote the McKinney-Vento Act. So if you've received services to help you out of homelessness, it's because of the National Coalition for the Homeless. We are truly proud of that history, but we're also proud of what we're doing today. And one of those things is making sure that you understand the realities behind homelessness in America. So we have two amazing guests today. Just really happy to have author Brian Goldstone, who has just received a Pulitzer Prize for his amazing book, There's No Place for Us. And one of the characters from that book, who is actually a real person, she is with us today. Her name is Celeste. And Celeste will be joining us to tell us a little bit more about her story. So we're thankful that you could join us. And we want to get right into the conversation. Lot of area to cover. And we're going to start with Brian. Brian, your book is deeply reported, but it's also deeply personal. What was the moment that convinced you that this wasn't just a story about poverty, but about the fundamental failure of the American housing system?
Yeah, it's a great question. And thank you so much for allowing me to be part of this conversation. And it's a special honor to be joined by Celeste. I don't think we've ever done a conversation like this together at the same time. So it's really special, very exciting. And I'm just very grateful to be with you. So the moment where I realized that this wasn't, as you put it, you know, just a matter of poverty, but something truly systemic, something truly broken in, I wouldn't just say in our housing system, but in our society, it actually came very early on when my wife, who's a nurse practitioner, her name's Elaine, she was working as a nurse practitioner at a community health center in Atlanta called Mercy Care. And we share a car. So every day I was picking her up from work. This is many years ago now. This is around 2018, I believe. And she was telling me about this trend that she was seeing where one patient after another, they were, you know, working at Walmart. They were working in Amazon warehouses. They were driving for Uber and Lyft. One man was even helping build sets for Atlanta's burgeoning film industry. And what all of these patients had in common was when they finished work, they weren't going to an apartment. They were going to an extended stay hotel. They were crowding into apartments with other family members. They were one person was sleeping in a street encampment. They were sleeping in their cars. So when she told me about that, I, you know, like many people, I have always wanted to learn more about homelessness. What is this thing that so many of us have been led to believe is just this kind of permanent, intractable feature of the American city? Where does it actually come from? Why are people without homes in the richest nation on the planet? And what Elaine was describing were actually people whose homelessness was out of sight and invisible. They didn't want their coworkers to know that they didn't have stable housing. They didn't even want some of their own relatives to know. And so when she told me about that, that led me to first write an article for the New Republic magazine following one family in Atlanta, who the mom, the head of household, was a home health aide, and they became homeless when their gentrifying neighborhood, when the house they had been renting in this gentrifying neighborhood was sold to an investor and their lease was terminated. And by the time I met them, they had been homeless for several months. When I finished that article, I just realized there was so much more to learn. So many colliding systems, again, not just the housing system, but so many colliding systems, the growing precariousness and volatility of work in America, not just low wages, but work that doesn't offer sick leave or health benefits, work where you don't know how many hours you're going to be getting from one week to the next, but also a lack of affordable health care, a lack of affordable child care. All of these things coming together to make this crisis not only possible, but arguably predictable and inevitable. And ultimately, you know, to your question about poverty, you know, a really astonishing realization for me was when I realized that this crisis of the rise of housing insecurity, the rise of homelessness among people who are working not just one job, but sometimes multiple jobs, the rise of a crisis where addiction, mental health issues are just as often the consequence of this insecurity as the cause, that this wasn't a crisis of poverty in the way we've been taught to think of that. It's actually a crisis of prosperity, a particular kind of prosperity, where all of this insecurity is just flourishing not in the poorest areas of the country, but in the richest, most rapidly gentrifying, most rapidly developing parts of our country. And so that felt very counterintuitive, but also really profound.
Awesome. A lot of really important topics in that answer to the question. One that I'll ask you, and then we'll go to Celeste, is, of all the things you encountered as you were doing this book, as you interviewed people, as you spent, you know, really quality time in their lives, what was most surprising to you? And what do you think would be surprising to some of the policymakers? I think you've touched on some of it, but anything to add to that question?
Well, I mean, this book is only possible because Celeste and the other four families who I didn't just follow, but kind of immersed myself in their lives as much as I possibly could for several years because of their generosity, because of their almost miraculous trust in the process that somehow allowing me in this way would allow readers to encounter the reality of what people are facing, often in the shadows and in this very invisible way. And in the intimacy of that process, there were so many things just on a personal, I mean, with Celeste, I can't tell you, I mean, just how in awe I was constantly of her specific strength, just, I mean, survival skills, just learning in this very improvised way to roll with what was coming her way. I mean, at one point in the book, Celeste begins a kind of restaurant out of her room at this awful extended stay hotel, and creating her own business. And then when the pandemic caused all the daycares to close, she started operating a kind of daycare out of her room. I mean, just totally incredible ingenuity, just power, the power of Celeste, the power of these other families, and how despite these overwhelming odds, just displayed incredible strength. On a more kind of macro systemic level, I would say one of the things that was just stunning to me was how much money is being made off people's insecurity, off of their desperation, that this isn't just about, okay, we don't have enough affordable housing units to meet the need, and so we have to make these numbers add up. There is a lot of capital, a lot of money invested in ensuring that this suffering not only continues, but is exacerbated, I'm sorry. And that was surprising to me, honestly. Just, you know, there's that famous line from James Baldwin about how extremely expensive it is to be poor in America. And I think what Celeste's story and so many other stories demonstrate is the flip side of that, how profitable, how lucrative this insecurity has become, where financial institutions, where Wall Street investors, private equity firms are actively, you know, buying up these extended stay hotels where people, when they lose their housing, are forced to go. And the conditions are abysmal, and yet the prices keep going higher and higher. And so that was really surprising to me, just, you know, that homelessness in this country really has become big business in a way.
It's amazing. There's a story last week. You'll find this kind of really in line with some of the things that happened during the book. And Celeste, I want to really talk to you about this. There was a hotel being run by the city of St. Paul. It was actually kind of an extended stay hotel that was actually turned into housing. Every week, the residents had to leave for the rooms to be cleaned. Some of that was in the book as well. Well, when these guys left this time, they were locked out of their units. And this is a place run by the city. And that's just an example. We heard some of that, you know, broken promises, things that weren't repaired on time. This was actually run by the city. It wasn't even a private vendor that was doing this. So those are some of the horror stories that are happening as we speak. Celeste, you're a true American hero. Some of the things that you did to keep your family stable. But I wanted to go back a little bit. Can you tell us about how your life was before it became unstable? Who were you?
I'm sorry. I was and still am a regular person. I had a job. At the time, I was working for a division of BMW. I was making great money. We had a decent home. My kids were going to school in the area where we were, and we were pretty fairly happy. A week before the fire happened, I'd actually just finished doing some remodeling to my home, in the kitchen, painting, fixing up things, because it was a home that I was renting to own, which in itself is a trap, I found out as well. I was in school going for paralegal. I was working, like I said, for a division of BMW. I was making decent money. I had a small amount of savings because I was at a point in my life where I was repairing my credit. I was rebuilding my life just from, you know, relocating to Georgia and trying to make a better situation for my family and I. And I felt that I was on the right track. And then the fire happened.
Yes. And that, you know, people, I think when people think about the resources that are available in a community, that when something like that happens, there's these resources that are available to you that help bridge the gap. And it doesn't seem like those were available to you. Was that a surprise to you that what you think is going to happen didn't happen for you?
On a lot of levels, yes, it was a surprise. Only because at one point in my life, I actually used to be a case manager at DFACS in the state of Florida, the Department of Children and Families. So I was the person who helped people get all of these resources. I was the person who helped people get Medicaid. I was the person who helped people get rent paid. I was the person who helped people find relocation services. And then I found myself in that very same situation. And all of the information that I knew firsthand that was supposed to be there to help, when I actually started going to seek those resources, I found that I fell through the cracks when it came to qualifying for a lot of the resources. You know, they would, for example, one place told me at the job that I had, I was making like $18 an hour. I was working 40 hours a week. Sometimes there was overtime available. So I was making decent money. I was making enough money that me getting rehoused shouldn't have been a problem. Until the day I went into a caseworker's office and she told me, well, we can help you get rapid rehousing. However, you got to participate in these programs in order to get the rapid rehousing. But since they conflict with your work schedule, quit your job and we'll help you find another job. But what sense does that make? Because I need the job. I need at least 3 months worth of paycheck stubs. I need to be making at least three times the rent. And I'm doing all of that. But you're telling me in order for your program to help me be rapid rehoused, I got to quit my job. So what sense did that make? And that is what I ran up against with a lot of the things. I fell through the cracks of qualifying for one reason or the other.
So that has to be very frustrating. And I think people have a lot of misconceptions about kind of that trajectory, you know, as you try to navigate the system. You know, you've heard the stereotypes before. What would you think from your experience is kind of the biggest misconception that people have? I think you touched on some of it, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
All people that are homeless are lazy. They don't want to work. They don't want to be in a better situation. They're comfortable where they are. Those are a lot of the misconceptions. And a lot of misconceptions that I found as well are, oh, you don't look homeless. How does homeless look? What is the look of homeless that you have? I am going during the day to work in a warehouse doing quality inspection. Then at night, I'm going to work at KFC as a cashier or as a food prep person. What does homeless look like? Mm-hmm. Because I'm clean every day. I go to work every day. What does homeless look like?
Exactly. And in my experience, the majority of the people are closer to your story than the stereotypical stories. And you talked about like a real frustration for me, the system being designed where you have to fit into the system as opposed to the system having an individual solution for you. You know, you needing not to work or to make less to be able to fit into a program versus having resources available. Brian, I'm going to go back to you for just a second. What do you think the government gets wrong about its design with homeless policy in your experience after working with these families? What is our system getting wrong? And this is for people like me who are advocates and also for policymakers. How can we make it a better system?
I think Celeste's own experience that she was just speaking to gets at a lot of what is just really fundamentally broken about how homeless services are delivered and made accessible or not for not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, but arguably millions of men, women, and children who are in desperate need of assistance. And I think that, you know, a lot of how homelessness is just imagined and discussed in this country has shaped the way that homeless services have themselves taken shape. And what I mean by that is, you know, so much of our imagination of homelessness is confined to what we see on the street.
Absolutely. And I say that all the time.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So, and it's not just a matter of, okay, well, there's actually people in other places, not just the street, but when what we see on the street are people who are visibly, tragically often in the grip of severe psychological distress, or they are in the grip of substance use or other really, really serious and chronic disabilities, the way to help people, if we are even interested in helping people, if the response is not going to take the form of criminalization and banishment and just trying to lock our way out of this problem or ticket our way out of this problem or jail our way, but if we are even interested in helping folks, the way that help is shaped will be, you know, in response to what people are dealing with. But so it's not just a matter of like, well, there are a lot of people in other places. It's the fact that someone like Celeste, you know, who is clocking into a job each day, clocking into two jobs, you know, each week, whose kids are in school, who is making a car payment and trying to do everything in her power to stay afloat, the kinds of solutions and the kinds of assistance that will help her might look very different than what that person with who needs really intensive kind of wraparound support might need. And yet, you know, when Celeste, I was with her when she went to the Hub for Homeless Services in Atlanta, I was with her when she was basically told, like, ma'am, I'm so sorry, you're not homeless in quite the right way. I mean, they didn't say those words exactly, but it was like, well, you don't meet HUD's definition of literal homelessness because you're not on the street or in a shelter. And it was just so cruel and arbitrary the way that she was just locked out of this basic support. I mean, just totally. So I think that what we've done is basically we've narrowed the lens on homelessness. We've distorted the focus. We've told ourselves this very comforting story that if people are homeless, it's because of these causes. It's because of mental illness. It's because of addiction. It's because, as Celeste was just saying, they don't want to work. They're lazy. We've told ourselves that story. We've narrowed the lens. And what we've managed to do is write out of the story everyone else, people like Celeste, literally write them out of existence. And so I think the brokenness of our system for addressing this crisis is a direct reflection of the brokenness of our knowledge, our insight into what homelessness actually looks like, who is becoming homeless in this country, and why.
May just add to what he just said, because you asked in the opinion what would be something that would make it work. Is yes, I know that they have guidelines. However, what needs to happen is that each case, each person, each family should be individually. What is the word that I'm looking for? It should be individually reviewed.
Maybe screened or reviewed or, yes.
Set of guidelines that you have, yes, for generally everyone. Mm-hmm. But based upon what the person's real life situation is, they need to be able to look at the person individually. Because what happens is they group everyone in and those guidelines just don't fall and don't work for everyone. It is an individualized thing. And a lot of the case managers, a lot of the community advocates, they need to understand that it is a individual person that is coming to you, not a group of people. So that's this right. person has to be reviewed individually and say, these are the services that this person needs and how can we get them for these people? Instead of saying, well, as a general overall, you got to go here, get this, go here, get this, go here, get this. I spent so many days getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting in front of places like Gateway here in Atlanta for hours, being the first or second person in the line, only to go inside and be told within a 5 or 10 minute period, oh, you don't qualify.
Mm-hmm.
How did you determine I didn't qualify? You said I needed a job. You said I needed to have 3 times the income. You said I needed this, and I have all of those things. So why don't I qualify? And nobody could ever clearly define reasons to me why I didn't qualify.
Well, you answered one of my questions. And that was what policy, if there was one policy, what would it be? And you talked about individual case management, screening, whatever term we want to use with that. I think the other thing is, you know, we need more prevention. We need to catch people before they start down this cycle, because once you get there, it's really hard to get out. But I think with your story, it's a real story of resilience. And, you know, I think people need to read this book, first of all, and they'll be really proud. Tell us, like, what was your proudest moment? What do you look back on and say, you know, this defined me. This really made me believe in myself and allowed me to use that belief to support my family. Were there moments like that? And I guess the other question were there any times where there were kind of acts of kindness within that system that you would talk about?
Throughout the whole time that I was homeless, what made me feel the best, what made me be able to survive through it all, was the massive amount of people outside of myself that depended upon me, that looked to me for help, that looked to me for advice. Because even when I didn't realize it myself, everybody else around me was drawing strength from me. Mm-hmm. Because I was the person that no matter what, I was going to find it out. I was going to find the resources, even if I couldn't take advantage of the resources. If you came to me and I could find it for you, I would. And that is what carried me through. That is what helped me the most. Those were my defining moments, when we would have food trucks come out and some families weren't there, and the people would say, hey, we're going to leave all this stuff here with you so we can make sure it gets to the people. Those were my moments.
Well, that is beautiful and amazing. And we really, you know, certainly I have so much respect for what you did. And those are the kind of things that really change communities and change the world, when we kind of take it upon ourselves to be the caretaker for others. And you certainly did that a number of times during the book. And I can hear the emotion in your voice as you talk about that. Brian, I'm sure you went through just a range of emotions. And so what part of this story frustrates you the most? I think you talked a little bit about the government, but what, as you've gone to conferences, I would be remiss to say that Brian won a Pulitzer Prize for this book. So it's not only a great reading for those in the movement, but it's an amazing piece of work for the general public. So I implore you to read it if you can. listened to it on Audible, as I've done both of those. I couldn't put it down, so I had to take it with me. But I wanted to hear from you, like, you know, if you were really talking about how this book really moved you, what did it do to you as a person? Not as an author, not as a reporter, but how did it change you personally? Sounds like you had some kind of introduction to what was happening from your wife. But even when you get a pre-introduction, the reality of what's happening, and I can say that about my own personal life, it really changes you. What did it change for you personally, Brian?
I wish I had a quick response to that question. I'm really still struggling to articulate, even now, the book's been out for over a year, really struggling to articulate the effect that this had on me. There are so many things to say. One is just, even before the book came out, the gratitude, just deep, deep, deep gratitude I felt for the honor, the gift of being allowed into Celeste's life, and into the lives of the other four families who I followed for this book, and just how transformative that was for me. Again, even apart from the quote unquote the issues themselves, apart from the systems, just the on a human level, the friendship that was formed. I mean, I just love being with Celeste. She's just a cool person, and she's also just smart as hell and just knows everything about everything and is funny and charismatic. And it was just a joy and a privilege to just be with her and to be with the others. And I felt myself changing in the process in ways that, again, I think are still kind of unclear to me, but I can feel it really deep down. You know, one thing that I felt throughout this process was also just anger, like real anger, even rage at all of the utterly unnecessary ways that these families, including Celeste's family, she and her children were forced to suffer. The ways, first of all, that she and the other families were, they didn't fall into homelessness. They didn't stumble into homelessness. They were pushed into homelessness. Mm-hmm. And beginning with that basic insight that this was something that was inflicted on them, made me very angry. And then in all these very micro everyday ways, to see the toxic stress that Celeste's, you know, children were forced to endure, to see the conditions that they were forced to live in at this extended stay hotel, and in a rooming house that they ended up in, and these other places where it's just like, how is this actually happening? And so I think that the feeling of anger was the dominant. I mean, yes, there was grief, there were many moments of laughter, of joy, but above all, it was anger that we are just allowing this kind of suffering to proliferate as we go about our days, and all of the kind of comforting myths that we indulge as a society. Beginning with the myth that people just, you know, are that basically blaming the victim, that they are where they are because of something that they've done. And I call it a comforting myth because it allows us to avoid the really, really hard questions as a society about what does it say about our country, about our economy, about how our economy works, where when someone like Celeste does go get a job, she never stopped working. That job is not even close enough to, it's not nearly enough to just afford this most basic human necessity, a roof overhead. And so in order to avoid asking those questions, We blame Celeste. We blame the victims, and it just lets us off the hook as a society.
Exactly. And I did ask you about, you know, some of the times that were most profound to you, Celeste. And Brian, thank you for touching on. We often in our language around homelessness, we one know it's just an experience, but people are forced into homelessness. Mm-hmm. Nobody, you know, decides to go, you know, hang out at a motel or at a shelter. It's something people are forced into because we don't have anywhere in this country where the housing costs meet the needs of people who are working at jobs that pay a minimum wage or Social Security or most jobs, especially a two bedroom. So we haven't talked as much about the children. How are they doing, Celeste? Are they adjusting? We haven't talked about kind of what's going on now. If you're open to share that, we'd love to hear one, how the kids are doing, because sometimes it can have long-term effects. And hopefully you're not seeing that. And kind of what's going on with you now, Celeste?
Right now, I am actually living in a transitional housing program.
Yes, I love that.
I am grateful for the housing. However, it is definitely a program that we are the pilot families in this program. And so a lot of the resources that were promised to us going into this program have not been lived up to. We are supposed to be getting out of the program in December. My daughter and I are in the program. If they told me to leave today, I don't know what I'd do. Mm-hmm. As the program has not prepared us in any way to be able to leave. Mm-hmm. Not all transitional housing programs are this way. It just so happens that in the county where I live, this is a new transitional housing program. Which, in my mind, one thing for transitional housing programs, it's a 12-month program, is not in any way, shape, form, or fashion a long enough time for people to come out of survival mode. Mm-hmm. And when I say survival mode, people don't realize that when you're homeless, your mind switches into this mode that, by whatever means necessary. Which, like Brian said, I was working two and three jobs. I was selling food out of my room. I was babysitting people's kids. I was going to grocery stores for people. I was washing people's clothes and folding clothes. Whatever I could do that could put the dollar in my pocket to survive is what I did. Working in corner stores, cleaning the stores. You know, people looking at me because physically I'm a very thin woman. And I had some dental issues. Right now I'm going through getting new teeth, which I will have tomorrow. Amen. Thank you, Jesus.
Amen.
And people would prejudge me based on my appearance. So I went through being mistreated a lot by people. Oh, you gotta be on drugs. I'm not on drugs. I go to work every day. I'm going through cancer treatment right now. Maybe that's why I'm sick and throwing up, and I still got to get up and go to work tomorrow morning. I don't have the luxury to sit down and have chemo one day and then not go to work the next day. Because if I do that, I don't have anywhere to live. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was harrowing even for my kids. I remember having my son in 2019. No, it was 2020. I'd gotten a feeding tube because I have a stomach disorder called gastroparesis. And I remember my son sitting on the porch of the place where we were living then. And he said, in tears, broken down, crying, "Mommy, I love you. This is the first time in years that I didn't feel like I was going to lose you at any moment because you're healthy right now." Mm-hmm. And it broke me down. It tore me apart, but I couldn't let them see that. I still, no matter what, had to keep moving every day. Mm-hmm. Because if I didn't, we didn't survive. Mm-hmm. So in the long run, it's affected my kids. Mm-hmm. You know, we have therapy now, and everyone is trying to rebuild and make life better. And it doesn't get any easier because these are long-term wraparound services that people need. They need the counseling. They need to learn about financial budgeting. They need opportunities to open bank accounts. They need stable child care to be able to go work. And although, like I said, I'm no longer living in the hotel right now, a lot of the conditions are still the same, which doesn't mentally and emotionally allow you to come out of a place of being depressed or a place of feeling like, where do I belong? Where am I going to go? What is going to happen to me? Because we're just not properly prepared right now, you know, and it just becomes just harrowing at times just to sit back and hear your kids tell you the different things that they've experienced or that they've thought about that you never even thought about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. You said so much there that really was so profound and so touching that I think one of the things you said that really sticks out to me, and I think about like where we go with policy in this country, like there's this move to move everybody to transitional housing. And what you said about it, what really stuck out to me is that transitional housing does not offer you a feeling of stability, a feeling of being settled. And then you went on to say a feeling of belonging. And, you know, if we go back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, he talks about belonging. And that's one of the things we try to do at NCH. And we think of it from that perspective, because if you have a time limit without an introduction to what's next, it's really, really a tough place to be in. But I just really, again, appreciate your resilience, your willingness to try everything to be able to do it on your own. But you shouldn't have to do that. Our society should be, we should have a place in our society that helps everybody, no matter what you're going through, to be able to get to that next step. And, you know, I go back to Brian, something you said too, even if you did have a substance abuse or mental health situation, there should be a place for that. There should be resources in place so people don't have to occupy the benches, streets, and sidewalks of our country. We should be taking care of those that have those issues.
Donald, could I just speak to that super quickly? Because as Celeste was just talking, you know, it occurred to me that you had mentioned prevention, the just how crucial preventing homelessness is, as important as getting people into housing they don't currently have is keeping them in the housing they do have right now and preventing this loss. And Celeste's story and what she was just describing, I think illustrates that so powerfully. And that, again, is where some of the anger I felt comes from, because you could just see how an early intervention, which really wouldn't even cost that much money, you know, could have not just been financially beneficial, you know, it wouldn't have cost so much more later on to get people the support they need, but just morally and on a human level, it would have prevented so much trauma, so much suffering, so much misery that is then layered on top of the original thing and has to be peeled back. And I think that, you know, we are accustomed, those of us who who have either been in the sort of academic research around homelessness or advocacy or direct services. We're accustomed to sort of dividing homelessness into these little categories and subcategories, chronic homelessness versus temporary homelessness and family homelessness versus, you know, individuals and on. But what I really saw during this reporting was how homelessness is really just a spectrum of insecurity, and how, you know, one of the benefits in following people for such a long period of time was to see how you could be evicted one day from your apartment, you know, and in school to become a social worker, in school to become a paralegal, evicted from your apartment, a house fire happens, now you're in your car, now you're in a hotel room. And a year from now, if that early intervention doesn't materialize, you could very well be on the street, and your children, this family could very well be broken up, and your children could be taken away by Child Protective Services. And now what you see with your eyes on the street is this person, this adult who is by themselves, and maybe they've begun to drink or use substances to just self-medicate the hopelessness of that there is nothing I can possibly do to improve my life. But that's all we see with our eyes. We see this individual, we don't see the children who were taken away. We don't see all of the thousands of opportunities to intervene early so that this pain never had to emerge to begin with. And so that's why prevention really is, on a policy level and just in the way we talk about these things, it just can't be emphasized enough that stopping homelessness before it starts is really where we have to be thinking.
Absolutely. The true statement is that homelessness is a manifestation of a broken system.
Yeah.
There's many places along that path that there could have been something that our system could have done to protect people, and we aren't doing it. And like you said, it's morally wrong, because when you do that, we have stronger cities, we have better cities, we have safer cities, but we're not doing the things to get there. So if you were talking to a governor, a member of Congress, or a HUD official, what would be the one message each of you wants to send to them? Well, why don't we start with Celeste? Celeste, what is the message you want any elected official that's hearing this conversation today to take away? What would be that one message?
For me, the most important thing would be individualized people. Yes, I understand that there are program guidelines. However, each person needs what's called an individual plan to actually help their families grow and become stable again. That's number one. Number two, when you are helping these people get into different programs and different housing, don't just help them and then leave them, abandon them, forget about them. Continue to put your feet on the ground. Continue to put your faces on the scene. Go meet the people who you're helping. Go see these people real time, face to face, live and in person. Because one thing, like those books on the shelf behind you, like any paperwork can only show you the logistics of what's going on. In order to see the actual physical evidence of how these programs are or are not succeeding for the individual, you got to go on the ground. You got to see the people. You have to interact. Those are the most important key things that I can tell any governor, any mayor, any housing official. We are human. We are not going to go anywhere. Every night, that you go home and you go in your comfortable home and you prepare a great meal for yourself and get to take a hot shower and lay down in a nice, warm, comfortable bed and do it every day. Think about the person who goes and sleeps in the woods in a tent. Or think about the person who doesn't get to go into a home and do all of those things. They're living in a hotel that has black mold in it, that has holes in the bathtub, that has rats and roaches and bed bugs. And then we're being penalized for those things. Think about those people, those children who are being taken from families that, if support had been given early on, would not have been taken from their families. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I would want every official to think about every single day. Mm-hmm. Because in all reality, unless you have a great substantial amount of savings in the bank, every individual, and I mean every individual, is one missed mortgage payment away, one missed paycheck away from being in the very same situation. Mm-hmm. It is that simple. Mm-hmm. Anything can happen in the blink of an eye. Today you can be up high in the sky, and tomorrow a natural disaster could come through and destroy everything. And then where are we left? Mm-hmm. That is when you see on the TV, oh, this community has been devastated because 50 people lost their homes. What are you doing to help those 50 people regain their homes?
Celeste, thank you so much. What a powerful statement. And I really thank you for just being just amazing in sharing your story as we draw closer to the end, and I really appreciate your courage, and we want to continue to work with you. So please email me so we can talk about other ways that we can support you. Brian, same to you. Just kind of, what would you say to mayors, the mayor of Atlanta, or the governor of Georgia, or some of your members in the House and Senate, or even all the way up to the administration, who says that law and disorder, to fix that, we got to put people in jail. But what would you say to those people?
I mean, hopefully I would have Celeste with me and I would just be able to say, listen to Celeste. I feel like I am, so much of what I'm able to just say and contribute to this conversation is solely because of what I have learned from Celeste and from the others, and just, you know, wanting to give their stories a platform. So I think it's so crucial that those who are closest to the problem, that we recognize that they are also closest to the solution, and that we don't need pundits and policy expert. We need to hear from the people themselves of what their experience has been. And that is how we will build our way out of the, or claw our way out of this crisis. Where we are right now as a country with the current administration, you asked what I would say to the head of HUD or folks who work at HUD. I mean, we have gone so far back and regressed so far into just, you know, into thinking that we can just brutalize, dehumanize, and really criminalize our way, you know, again, out of this crisis. And so I would make one statement and I would ask one question. The statement would be that the reason people are homeless in this country is because they don't have homes that they can afford. Like, that is the reason why people are homeless. In the richest nation on the planet, people are homeless because they don't have access to homes that they can afford. And there are all these other risk factors that might make you more likely to be one of those folks who becomes homeless. But that fundamentally, housing is at the root of homelessness. So I would begin with that statement. And then I would ask a question. if housing is at the center of why homelessness exists, certainly on this scale, on this disastrous, calamitous scale in America, how is it that we have allowed housing, this precious resource, this thing that everybody needs, just a roof overhead, how have we allowed it to become this thing that is hoarded up and auctioned off to the highest bidder? How mm-hmm. have we allowed, you know, what we solemnly refer to as the law of supply and demand or the market to dictate whether people have access to this most basic human necessity? We don't do that with education. We say that a K through 12 education is so important that we are going to make it not just free, but compulsory for children K through 12. That is just what it means to live in a functioning society. And yet with housing, we've said, if you can afford it, great, you can have it. And if you can't afford it, well, now you're left to fend for yourself in what Carla Wells, a case manager in the book, refers to as the housing hunger games. And I just would want to say to our elected officials, how have we allowed housing to be treated in such a way? And to remind them that there are so many other ways of going about it, that we can treat housing as a public good, no different than clean water or roads or bridges, that it is a public good worth investing in public ways, and that it is possible. The good news is that all of this suffering is a policy choice, because if that is a policy choice, then the good news is that we can choose differently. This is not some Greek tragedy where we were just struck with this. It is a choice that we have made as a society, and we can begin to choose differently with our budgets, with our policies, and with our votes.
Well, that is amazing. And I hope they listen to this. I hope some of our policymakers do take the opportunity to hear the voices of homelessness. We thank you both so much for being with us today. This has been an amazing discussion. I'll take away so much from it. The housing hunger games is just an amazing statement. But I will also take away that there are so many people in this country that have been forced into this situation. They try everything possible to get out, and they just need a helping hand from those who are making the decisions in this country. Homelessness is not inevitable. Homelessness is not colorblind, and homelessness can be solved. If policies are made, they can be changed. We need to figure out a way where we start to support poor people in America, even if it doesn't poll well. And we've seen it happen. We've seen it happen after COVID. We've seen it happen four other times in the history of this country. We need to get back to that. And I thank you for listening to the Voices of Homelessness. Amazing guest. I want to thank Brian Goldstein and Celeste for being here with us, for sharing so deeply about their experiences and their personal stories. And we hope that you'll continue to listen to the Voices of Homelessness, because that's how we get out of this. Housing should be a human right. Housing should be decommoditized in this country, decommodified in this country. And we should get to a place where we no longer see people living on the streets in the richest country in the world. So I thank you very much. Please join us for next episode. We really appreciate you, and have a wonderful time.